The impulse to wring our hands at the lack of leadership and accountability in our nation is understandable. Whether we're talking about utter surrender in the face of the deadly COVID-19 pandemic or the outrageous racialized response to mostly peaceful protests, it sure is hard for ordinary citizens to accept responsibility when elected leaders don't. But this time around, voices of moral courage are challenging each of us to do just that, to which I want to add the reminder that the nation we are blessed to inhabit was created not by politicians nor strategists, but by idealistic young civilians who dared to dream this big. Kerry Connolly is a writer, mystic, and coach whose powerful new book is titled Good White Racist, Confronting Your Role in Racial Injustice. It's a book at the most difficult and most important point of the current conversation around race in America, and I am so happy to have the author with us on State of Belief Radio. Kerry, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here today.
As I read your incredibly timely book, my thoughts kept returning to the way Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. characterized what he called the white moderate. King was writing to fellow faith leaders while imprisoned in Birmingham. Now, that letter was dated 16 April, 1963. It feels like the people he was describing have still not heard those words. What do you think?
I would agree. I would agree with that statement. And in many ways, I think it's also, in a way, it's gotten worse in that because of the civil rights movement, so many people have come to realize that being racist is a really bad thing, right? And we don't want to be associated with this imagery that we have of different water fountains for different people and different restrooms for different people, right? That's the imagery that we have. And so what's happened is a lot of people who white people who truly want to aspire to the beautiful imagery that Dr. Martin Luther King gave us, we choose to be colorblind. We want to say, oh, we're not going to talk about this because talking about it is, you know, when we point out that there's some one thing that's white and one thing that's not white, and just that binary is problematic. But when we talk that way, it sounds like we're being racist, and we don't want to be racist. And so what that has essentially led to is a lot of white people who think they are doing the right thing by not talking about race, by being so-called colorblind, and yet they have yet to do the really hard work of deconstructing the inherent racism that has been, what even if they didn't want it there, it's been embedded into our psyches through media and through our family systems and through all sorts of messaging that we get from all different places. And we have to learn how to own that and how to practice agency over it in order for these things to really change.
So how do we skip this most critical step? How do people of goodwill get to keep feeling great about themselves as decade after decade passes?
That's a really good question. And I, you know, going back to, I love that you brought up Dr. King's letter, because, and his famous speech, of course, the I Have a Dream speech. You know, one of the things that we love to do as white people is we love to hold on to that imagery of Dr. Martin Luther King gave us of little white children and little black children holding hands and playing together and this beautiful vision. And yet we skip over the more challenging aspects of Dr. King's work, where he was challenging white people to do better, where he was telling us that we needed to really take a look at our systems of poverty and systemic racism and change them and make structural change. And very often it's kind of been shown that as policy comes into play that makes racist actions illegal, racism just becomes more covert. It just kind of goes underground and the language changes, right? So that things are happening in the background that are, if not as impactful, they're probably more impactful because you can't overtly point to a water fountain now and say, hey, that's blatantly racist, right? Now it's more covert. And whiteness as a construct is intended to be invisible to white people. And so it's really easy for us to go through life because we don't have to experience racism. So it's really easy for us to go through life and never have to actually think about it and about how we participate in it.
Slavery built this nation. That's what American capitalism itself was built on, exploitation of human and natural resources without cost nor consequence. Have we placed too much emphasis on material well-being and ignored the spiritual, moral, and physical inequalities that are all around us?
Oh, yes. Yes, I think that's a very true statement. And I think that one of the things that we have as a community, as a nation, one of the things that we have done that is so heartbreaking to me is that we have dehumanized ourselves. As white people, we dehumanize ourselves every time we refuse to see another human being as fully human, whether that human being is imprisoned in jail for a crime, whether that person, that human being is disagreeing with us about something, whether that human being is of a different race than ours. I think that's one of the first things that we do is let's dehumanize this person just a little bit so that I can feel safer and more righteous and more right in my thinking. You know, slavery is still legal in the United States. It's still legal. And there are plenty of brands. I won't name them, but you can do a Google search. There are plenty of brands that most of us buy from who still use slavery through the form of prisoner labor. And it's a huge problem. And I think it's something that not a lot of Americans really understand about our Constitution and about what's actually still happening and the deep crisis and the complexity of the prison industrial system. And how it's still enslaving people. And the fastest growing population in prisons right now are Black women. And I'm just going to say that the idea of a prison for profit is a terrifying idea. In what reality should we ever give incentive to have more criminals, to criminalize more people and imprison more people? Why would a country, why would an economy think that was a good idea?
Is there a most damning sin that good racists commit without knowing what they're doing or at least pretending not to know?
I call that a practiced not knowing. This idea of, you know, I'm seeing all this evidence and I'm going to pretend it's not really there. And I think that one of the things that white people do a lot is we tend to gaslight the BIPOC community, Black, Indigenous, people of color. And one of the ways that we do that on a societal level, and we do that on an interpersonal level. You know, if I'm talking to a Black person who's expressing rage and anger and hurt and pain, and then I tell them, oh, it wasn't so bad. Oh, you're just being oversensitive. That, you know, that's a form of gaslighting. Oh, they probably didn't mean it that way. That's a form of gaslighting, you know, but that happens even on the societal level. And the Take a Knee movement, for example, is a perfect example of how, as a nation, whiteness gaslit the BIPOC community, because, you know, the players who were kneeling were simply attempting to protest police brutality in this country. They were attempting to bring attention to this very specific thing. And what we did was we said, we're not going to talk about that. That's the point, but we're not going to talk about that. We're going to talk about all of these other things. And in fact, when you look at all of the other things that people bring up, things like it's disrespectful to our flag or to our troops, it's unpatriotic. It's you shouldn't protest on, I paid for a ticket to come watch this game. You shouldn't protest on my time. There's no actual victim in any of that, in any of those categories. Right. But meanwhile, over here, Black people are still dying. And yet we're sitting here going, we're not going to talk about that. We're not going to talk about Black people dying. We're going to keep pointing over here where there's actually no victim. And so that's kind of that's what I would call the greatest sin that we participate in as in white people, is this practiced not knowing, this, I'm going to refuse to see what is obviously in front of my face.
You have an evangelical Christian background, as do I. You even attended seminary, so I know we can zero in on the good racists among people of faith. Talk yes. about the chapter on faith that's a part of this book.
So, you know, the history of racism is deeply embedded with the history of the church in America. And I think that as the church, we need to own that, right? We need to address that. And I don't see, especially in evangelical spaces, I have not yet seen a collective lament about our participation in that sin. I want to preface this by saying, I get it. Okay. I've been on church staffs. I understand leadership, the dynamics and the problems of leading a church and caring and pastoring a church. But I think that sometimes there has been such a concentration on not being divisive, on unity above all else, when in fact, unity equals silence. And so very often white churches will tend to maintain a status quo and silence voices that are attempting to speak out to point to injustice and racial inequality. And those voices tend to be silenced because they are told that they're being divisive and unity above all else. The invitation that I offer and that I hope for, because I do believe that if racism began in the church, then the church can heal it, right? I have great hope for the church that we can truly enter into a sackcloth and ashes lament over this, which would move us to repentance, which would eventually move us to conciliation. But I think that church leaders sometimes fear stirring those waters and troubling those waters. And there is a cost very often. I've seen pastors lose congregants, tithing congregants. That's a very important thing because those tithes support staff salaries and all that kind of stuff, right? So these are difficult matters, but they are still important. It's important to wade into those waters and trouble them. It's important to be peacemakers and not peacekeepers, right? And there is a difference. There's an important difference between peacemakers and peacekeepers.
Yeah. A few years back, I was speaking to a group of clergy persons, and I was opposed and condemned for saying that I view racism as a sin. That's already a conversation that happens far too seldom, and if it does, it gets shut down for the very reasons that you're talking about. So how do we get leaders of more religious bodies to take that simple but essential first step this is sin.
Yes. Yeah. You know, I think to work in anti-racist spaces in any way, shape, and form, the most important work is the work that we all do on ourselves. You know, I've had people come to me and ask me, well, I want to start doing work in this. And I said, well, then the first thing that you have to do is you have to get some skin in the game. You have to be willing to make mistakes. You have to be willing to be vulnerable. You have to be willing to look foolish, maybe. And these are all things that I know pastors are not necessarily inclined to do, you know, and I get that. But I think that especially one of the hardest things for us to do as leaders is to admit, hey, we might not know what we're doing here, but I'm going to do my best and I'm going to make mistakes when I do this. And I'm going to ask that you call me out. And when you call me out, I'm going to do my best to work through my defensiveness and to hold my defensiveness and stay silent and listen and submit to the leadership of people of color and the BIPOC community. You know, I wouldn't be doing this work if it wasn't for Jesus and if it wasn't for being challenged by the Jesus that I see on the pages of scripture, who was not messing around with stuff like this. You know, Jesus challenges me to do this. If it wasn't for Jesus, I would not be in this work. So I think first and foremost, it's a real examination of our own hearts. And then it needs to be followed up with bold, decisive action and leadership that is willing to trouble waters.
Yeah. This is, for me, a really important question because I know it happens. How does a good racist ever change in a positive direction when he or she does not see that he or she has done nothing wrong?
Yeah. I mean, from my experience, because whiteness is constructed to be invisible to white people, there is a point in time or a period of time in which you really don't know. You really don't know, right? You didn't realize that redlining was a thing. Right? You didn't know that all that stuff happened. But then there comes a point in time when you know. And at that point in time, then you have a choice. You can either become the good white racist who's going to stay colorblind and pretend like none of this is happening. And that's where you're knowingly entering into the place of practiced not knowing, right? Or you can start to go, wow, I didn't know that. And I have found that usually it's a slow progression, right? You start to think about something, somebody makes a point, you listen to things, you have really defensive, angry feelings. And then as you start to listen more, you change more and you start to learn more. And I've equated it with going through the stages of grief, right? As we learn that this stuff is within us, we do go through a period of grief, which includes all of the steps like denial and anger. And finally, we get to acceptance. And once we get to acceptance, then we can start to go, okay, this is something that's in me. And I'm never going to get to a place where it's not in me. It's always going to be here. And I need to practice agency over it and be aware of it.
Is there something important that you would like to say that I haven't asked you about during our time together? Because I want to be sure that what you think is most important gets said.
Oh, thank you for that. I'm going to say that the most important thing for a good white person who truly wants to heal the racial divide in our country and who really wants to be an anti-racist is that we have to start to become comfortable with being uncomfortable. The process of uncovering our own inherent racism and the racism in our country, the process of suddenly realizing that our country that we love so much has never actually lived up to its own ideals, that process is disheartening and it's uncomfortable and it's depressing. And I invite people into that. I invite people to enter into that space prayerfully and with Holy Spirit, but to stay there and to allow themselves to be examined and to sit with that discomfort for a good long time. And I think from there we'll be healing.
Carrie Connolly is a writer, mystic, and coach whose powerful new book is titled Good White Racist, Confronting Your Role in Racial Injustice. You can learn more about the book and Carrie's work at www.carrieconnolly.com. Carrie, this conversation could not have been more timely. Every crisis offers at least a sliver of hope for real progress, and your prescription for it will be useful for many. I thank you for taking the time to be with us on State of Belief Radio, and I certainly wish and hope that people take it seriously and make the change that you are trying to help all of us make.
Thank you so much for inviting me to be here. I so appreciate it.